Welcome to the Inside Songwriting Podcast. This is where songwriters find inspiration every time. Hey, thanks for being here, and you've reached episode 8 of the Inside Songwriting Podcast. My name's Carl Brody, and I'm happy to be here with you, talking to you from the clifftops of Sydney. However, we're going to dive right into an interview I did yesterday afternoon with a good friend of mine who you may remember me ranting on about in last week's podcast, episode 7. Michael Roberts is very much a mentor to me and a great friend, and a deep well of knowledge on all things songwriting. So I'm sure you're going to find this interview really interesting, and you're going to get a lot of value from it. This is part one because it was quite a lengthy conversation, so we just sat down and rambled on as we usually do. We'll go straight to that interview now. Enjoy. So I'm sitting here in Tempe, Sydney, with my good friend Michael Roberts, and as expected, we had a conversation when I arrived that I was wishing I was recording everything we were talking about, because there was a lot of value in that conversation. And as mentioned in last week's podcast, we usually end up on the topic of songwriting, no matter what it is we intend to talk about in the first place. So thanks for coming on the Inside Songwriting Podcast, Michael Roberts. Welcome.
Carl Brody, happy to be here, my friend. And yeah, songwriting. We could and we do rabbit on endlessly about it.
Well, no, we're both so passionate about it, and we come at it from different angles, like that plane, and from the same angle oftentimes as well. We might pause each time there's a plane. On last week's episode, I gave you a bit of a wrap on all the areas of my life that you're involved in, as well as being a friend. And rather than me continue with that, maybe just give us a bit of an intro as to who you are, what you do, or maybe even start with any current projects you're working on or have been working on recently.
Yes, well, thanks for the kind words. I guess, like yourself, I'm dedicated and passionate to good songs, I guess, and it's been a lifetime for me. I've got slightly older than you, so I go back a little way. But yeah, I got excited about music, you know, as a teenager. Got very interested in good songs. And then I realised after a while that was the thing that kept me going back to certain things. It was the quality of the songs. And then I got interested enough to attempt to write my own songs. Started with a band and a friend. My best friend was a guy called Anthony Aykroyd, who is now quite a well-known comedian, funnily enough, in Australia. And
this is all back in Tasmania.
This is back in Tasmania. So we were two good Catholic school boys. We got past that. And we started writing. We fancied ourselves to be Lennon and McCartney, hilariously. And we gave it our best shot at being songwriters with a band. So we ended up signing a publishing deal with Wheatley Brothers Publishing at the time, Tumbleweed Music, and they were, the time we signed them, they were one of the hottest organisations around, because they had Little River Band, who were like number one in America, I think, the week we signed with them. This was in the very late 70s, and we were teenagers.
So you were in good company in that publishing.
We were, and it was, you know, for various reasons, I guess, we didn't become successful by most terms as songwriters, in that we didn't get covers of our stuff or have great hits ourselves. But we went on a bit of a journey, and we wrote good songs, I think, and then life happened, and we ended up in different, you know, different strands of the entertainment industry. So yeah, but the love for good songs never left me, and I guess that's, you know, when we met, that's it's what I think sparked our friendship and our relationship, was we bonded over a love of good songs, and you know, I was intent to try to help you on your journey pull out, you know, whatever you needed to find what does it mean to write a good song? How do you write a good song?
I've got to say that, Michael, you can be a really harsh critic at times. And that's, I mean, we learn over the years to take that well.
Some people take it better than others.
Yeah, I was going to say most of us do. And I think that it's one of the best qualities you can have as a songwriter is to just learn to take it on the chin. It's someone's opinion, and you can heed the wise words of someone that you trust. Or you can let it get to you and let it dent you and send you back a few steps, you know, in your process. But I've always valued your input, and you, as you know, sometimes I'm quite defiant, and when I mentioned you being quite a harsh critic, I remember you saying to me at one point a couple of years ago, we were listening to something, and you said that you switched it off because life's too short to listen to bad songs.
Yeah,
and
a bit of a credo of mine.
It depends where you're coming from, and of course, if it's excruciatingly bad, none of us want to listen to it. But you know, I guess it depends on the situation. If we're helping someone out and we want to advise them,
yeah, that's a different story. It depends on your level of tolerance too. But
but my question was because you said that you from an early age you gravitated towards the good song, and I know that in my case I find it hard to explain that when I'm asked how I got into music and why music is such a major part of my life. At what stage it was all about songwriting. I mean, I kind of know a few moments in music class at school or whatever when I recognised that the composition part of what we were learning always appealed to me. And do you think that that's often the case with songwriters, is that we know from a very early stage, or do you think that sometimes we can just discover that about ourselves?
I think it reflects the person's own set of interests and values. And you look for what resonates within that set of interests and values. And I found, you know, particularly once you start to think about it, what was it that drew me to music? I mean, with some people it's the glitz, it's the glamour, it's the flash, it's the sex, it's the beat, it's something that's, you know, what you might call ephemeral or transitory, and that's fine. I mean, you know, great music can be, well, great experiences can be very superficial. That's what they're meant to be. Some great pop music is disposable. It's kind of meant to be. But underneath that too, music has different layers. There's lots of stuff to be discovered, and the throwaway stuff comes and goes, and you enjoy that. You tends to be you know, on the frivolous end of pop music. But, you know, I grew up in an era when pop music was coming of age and had already kind of grown out of its adolescence and, you know, thrown away its kind of juvenile aspect and was finding more expressive and deeper ways, you know. So the great singer-songwriter boom of the early 70s, kind of, I grew up on the back of that and got interested, you know, when a lot of those guys, they, you know, particularly the greats, ended up wanting to express their own life in their art rather than write third person kind of remote, you know, constructs that weren't personal. So I came to music on the back end of that idea. To me, that meant that what was inside me was responding to the conversations that these people were opening up, the humanity within what they were doing that was personal to them, but there was obviously some sort of universality about it, and that's what I responded to. But not everyone did. Some people just wanted, you know, like a good tune because it's a good tune, it's hummable. Some people, it's a good, you know, throwaway kind of lyric that you respond to. And that's fine. Music is a lot of things to a lot of people. But for me, it was like the things that resonated seemed to be a bit deeper, a bit more philosophical. So for whatever reason, that's what I responded to. And maybe that's why I wanted to write it. So,
but I think that one of the great things about you is that you, when it comes to which area a songwriter is focused on, you're so adaptable. and you're across, I don't know, you have this ability to retain all this information, and then when you're asked, you can share it and deliver it in a way that we comprehend, because you articulate it so well. But with say for example, some of these bands you speak of that maybe initially were after the fame, invariably they do. There's a point in their career where they do actually want to start, they suggest to their record company that the next album they want to make is really personal and a lot more earthy and so on. And I remember I went to see, well, how could I forget? I went to see Bob Dylan at the Brixton Academy in London.
Wow.
And in 2005, and the opening act was Elvis Costello.
Yeah, I've got the bootleg.
I need that. Bare Bones, acoustic. Yeah. He stood out. And the thing is that's the kind of music I was into anyway at the time. Not the only kind of music, but I knew that I loved it. And it's fascinating to me that audiences and fans can love a band so much for what they became famous for, but then when they stand up there with an acoustic guitar and the songs really hold up on their own, they cherish that even more, and that's what they talk about. They don't talk about the album so much as those experiences when those songs actually stand up on their own. And I think that as of growing older with all my experiences in songwriting, those are the songs. That's why initially I realized that I was interested in the songwriting side of things.
Mm.
But that was revealed to me later in life.
I think you see songwriting as a form. It's an interesting beast, because you're talking about, Costello, who made 3 or 4 seminal albums. The first things that he did, they were very band-focused albums with The Attractions and with the first session band that he used, which was kind of Huey Lewis and the News, did the first record, which was, Magic, Allison and all those things. They were actually American players. Then he uses the British band, very compressed, very direct kind of sound, and, really brought a musicality to punk, supposedly, that wasn't there with some of the other punk acts. He's a walking encyclopedia, Costello, of music, a closet anthropologist when it comes to musicians, a musicologist. And so he he's cursed with all of that. He's cursed with a literary sensibility. He's got all of this stuff working for him. But the bands created... What a curse. Bands created great records, really, with licks and fills and, great ideas from Steve Naive and good hooks and all the rest of it. But he could still stand up with an acoustic guitar, play those songs, and you got them. Now, that's, you struggle now to think a lot of pop music you listen to on the radio or come across, are they translatable, or just an acoustic guitar and a voice? And, it's still a bit of a template that works, and people love that. People can get together and strum a guitar and have a bit of a sing-along. It's probably still the old songs that people will bring out in that case. Costello might have contributed a few, but people will still go back to the Beatles songs, the Kink songs, the Stone songs, Creedence songs. They're great. They're great. There you go, the dogs. they're great. It's modern folk music, I think Steve Earle said a great thing about the Beatles was it was modern white boy folk music. I know exactly what he meant. It's Costello got up at, I think it was Live Aid, and said, "Here's an old northern folk song," and sang "All You Need Is Love."
Yeah, right.
And
that's fantastic.
They're our modern, they're the things that the minstrels used to travel around with and entertain people with. This is the modern equivalent of it. And if you can contribute to that roster, then you're doing pretty well.
Well, that's right. And as popular and as successful as some of the artists are today with what are also called songs, I'm sort of fearful of mentioning names, but say, for example, someone like Kanye West. This is not a criticism at all, but in terms of songwriting, you'd be hard-pressed to get those songs to stand up with an acoustic guitar.
Absolutely. It's a different headspace. And those songs are good constructions. They're good statements of, artistry. And they're meant to be absorbed and enjoyed and whatever, cogitated on if that's the case, and for lots of different things, but it's not, that's not their function, I guess. So, you know, I appreciate them for what they are, but yes, you do, you're probably not going to see Kanye's stuff. Someone's going to render it with an acoustic guitar and a voice particularly easily.
Well, that's right.
I mean, that tradition is going to change a little, I guess.
The appeal is always going to be there for music that that is, you know, not necessarily based on a song that can stand up on its own with an acoustic guitar or a piano.
The ideas might in those things. The ideas might be interesting, but yeah, it's I think what we're talking about a real folk tradition, and that's, you know, pop is part of the folk tradition, oddly enough. Rock is part of the folk tradition. It's a catch-all. It's a way of communicating. It's not a set of, you know, redundant ideas. It's a completely self generating and self changing model. Folk songs now, you know, you write folk songs, you write country songs, you write pop songs, but it's all folk, if you like. It's a way of speaking from one person to another in a poetic way, in a lyrical way.
That's the beautiful thing about pop music, I guess, and the evolution of pop music, is that we're over the years we have more and more influences that seep into our creative process. And I mean, I just found that exciting rather than wishing it was like it was back then.
Yeah.
And I remember, I think it's in Don't Look Back, when in 65, when Dylan's on stage at the Albert Hall, or he's just come off stage, and someone asked him, one of the journalists asks him how he gets, he's standing there on his own with his harmonica, he's in the spotlight with his harp and his guitar, and he's asked how he gets them to listen. And he says, man, that's beyond me. I just get out there and play.
Mm.
And I think that comes down to the constructs of the song, ultimately, just being brilliantly dynamic in every way in the first place. And I think that what we're talking about with things like Kanye, it's a lot of it is production-based.
Sure.
And that holds a lot of appeal.
Mm. You know? But that's, you know, there always was production. Production is... Sure, it's a tool like any other. And depending on the worth of what you've got to surround any song with, the production can be a key. But, you know, Lennon would play Strawberry Fields Forever on acoustic guitar. You listen to it and it's pretty compelling, just acoustic guitar and voice. Man, the production that they came up with is, you know, it's out of this world. It's full of all kinds of other things that actually bring something amazing to that song. So there's two different experiences here. There's the underlying song, which is kind of trippy and you know, vibey and melodic and lyrical and quite remarkable in its own way.
Well, those carnival sounds and horn sections.
Absolutely, but then there's this way that they realise it with getting in the hothouse of, what can we do to the guitar to make it sound like this? Or let's bring in a mellotron playing a flute, right? Okay, here's a line, you know, so someone comes up with that. You know, McCartney has the opening from, you know, The Gods that he brings in that's just perfect. And it becomes something else. So it becomes a conversation of between the song and the production. And that's fine. I think that's all good. But at the end of it, you know, they started from a good place. And the thing that informs any of the greats, anyone's ability to provide something, you know, useful or worthwhile or universal that someone will respond to, at the end of the day, it's honesty. You know, Lennon and McCartney wrote honestly about what they wanted to present. And they also had the balls to look each other in the eye and go, that's not good enough, you know. And that was the thing between them. There was this competition which really pushed each other's buttons, you know. So if someone came up with a good thing, the other one would have to top it. And that was their process. So, you know, if you don't have someone to bounce stuff off, and, you know, songwriting is sometimes a conversation with yourself, that's difficult. And you
I
have
think that's
to...
what makes them ultimately an exception to the rule in terms of a partnership, but also an exception to the rule with... They did their research. and they aimed for greatness every time.
Yeah.
Granted, they were the first ones doing that, studying musical theory, whatever it was, for their dynamics, and just to make every moment of every song brilliant. They're an exception to the rule. I mean, that's why we talk.
They're kind of the benchmark, I guess. You talk about them as, you know, or Dylan or any of the really interesting writers, Paul Simon, from the, you know, that really set the template of, you know, the bedrock of modern songwriting comes from those giants of the 60s. And that's the same thing that everyone, you know, in film, it's the same. You stand on the shoulder of giants. But if they've set the benchmark, then it's not up to you to sort of lower it. You know what I mean? I think, yeah, every time you step up to write, you should be not self-consciously going, I'll never write a song as good as, you know, those guys. It's not really about that. It's about being honest with yourself and writing something that's expressive and honest. And the difficulty then is to, if you've really not created something that is inauthentic, that is something that you haven't been able to, you know, render authentically or honestly, is to recognizing that's difficult. And some people need, as you know, we've had these conversations, and you say, oh, I might be brutally honest in some areas, but there's no point being tiptoeing around some stuff. If it's not worthwhile or working, then there's worth in having a conversation with someone about it. Even at the end of it, you know, I think good art, you have to fight for it. You should, you know, I should be able to come to you and say, I don't think that works because of this and this. And you should be able to articulate why you think it does.
Well, it's one of the hardest barriers to overcome when you first start co-writing, is because you've been writing on your own.
You've got no, who is this person? How sensitive are they to criticism?
Yeah.
You can't. I mean, you have to be. You still have to be civil. You can't sit in a room with a songwriter and go, "Wow, that idea sucks." You know, there is a conversation there that has to be had, that has to be delicate. But at the same time,
I just had a flash of all the conversations in Nashville that go on day after day,
no doubt,
8 times a day,
and I'm sure there are
places
absolutely, and I'm sure there are people who are very direct with their criticism, and others that are less.
Well, I'm suggesting, you know, that most people, they're saying it to themselves silently, and at the end of the day, they go and tell their friends or keep it to themselves.
That guy's rubbish.
A bunch of crap. That's not.
Yeah, exactly, and that's a bit sad, because with a little bit of openness, you can probably get past the bull and go, look, you know, I know what this is, and it's, you know, people have different levels of being able to either accommodate criticism or to give criticism, but at the end of the day, you know. You have to say the song wins, the best idea wins, and it's if you can take the ego out of the equation, and that's a delicate balance, because you need ego to write a song, because something has to tell you, I'm good enough to write a good song, and that's an ego. That's fine. You need that. You absolutely should have that, but you also need then this other little voice at the back of your head to go, is this any good? Am I being honest with myself? And I've done it myself. I've written, and it's hard. You know, I've written stuff that I think is really good, and 3 months later I go, wow, I thought that was good. You know, and that's, you need a bit of distance sometimes to get away from something. You fall into patterns. I've thought that I've, you know, written something good, then I've written something a little while later that I thought was good, and then, you know, 6 months later I look back and go, wow, it's the same song. How did I not see that?
Hence the importance of running your songs by someone that you trust, or even playing them live, if that's what you do, if you're a performance songwriter, running them live, you learn so much from it. I'm going through a process at the moment with a couple of songs where I'm giving them a run. In the not so every gig's important, but in the not so important gigs,
sure.
And each time I'm assessing them, I'm thinking about them afterwards and wondering what I could do to change. Why was there a part in that song that wasn't quite feeling like it was there?
Yeah,
and so that's one of many of my creative processes.
I think I've always said to people that I produce that I will challenge you and come up with ways of unlocking whatever it is within you to provide, you know, the best that you can provide. But it's up to you to step up to the plate and defend yourself and defend those songs. And really, at the end of the day, the only criticisms that I will have to make that should resonate with you are the ones that you actually have of yourself. That conversation with yourself, the criticism within yourself that says, Yeah, look, I kind of thought that about that too, but I wasn't kind of admitting it to myself. But yeah, now that someone else says it, yeah, I don't like that bit for this or that, or that never really worked in my head, but I wasn't kind of clear on it. But I think, yeah, that right. So, you know, whatever those criticisms are, sometimes the only ones that will hold water are the ones that you kind of agree with yourself, that resonate with yourself. But you might not have been in a position to criticise yourself about, you know what I mean? So you have this odd dynamic of, if you're really honest, is that what you think? And, you know, sometimes you won't be honest with yourself, and sometimes it needs to have a conversation to tease that out. The trick is to try to get to a place within yourself that you're comfortable with that, that you can more often than not recognise your own failings and work on them. You know, a great song is never finished, it's only abandoned, someone once said. I think
I like that.
Maybe that could be right, but at some point you have to put it down. You know?
Why do we abandon them when we abandon them? Usually,
yeah,
because our ego's getting in the way. Because, hang on a second, I've written songs way better than this. I'm going to start again.
Mm.
And that's what we have to deal with. And then we either give it the attention it deserves.
Sure.
Either now or later down the line.
Everyone has different...
Or
yeah.
It stays unfinished.
Yeah, it stays unfinished. And it's weird. I mean, you know, I have a brother who's musical. Brother Paul, and he's written a couple of the best songs that you'll ever hear, beautiful pop songs, but he's his own fiercest critic, and if he starts a song and thinks, he's told me, that it's not going to cut it, it's not going to be really top shelf, he throws it away, and he'll throw away what would be the scraps of a great idea for another songwriter, and it'll be abandoned and left and never heard. And
which is too bad for everyone.
I guess, that's his approach to it. You know, other people keep scraps and scraps around, and then they're looking for something, and then they go, oh, you know, 5 years ago I wrote this little piece of doggerel on a piece of paper, and now actually I can use that and turn it into something good. And everyone's got different techniques.
Question, isn't it? But it's interesting because it's obviously not arrogance with the ego getting in the way. And the ego is not sitting in the shadows either.
That's insecurity,
I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because he's going, if I can't proudly take this out and show it as a really top-shelf piece of work, as something that has, you know, that stands up against my standards, then bugger it. I'm throwing it out. And you're going, yeah, that's a pretty harsh way to work. And therefore, you know, he will write, you know, 2 songs a year and they'll be great.
Well, look, I know Paul, and I've heard his brilliant EP, and he is a great songsmith. And it's too bad for the rest of us that he doesn't churn them out year after year.
Well, is that better than, you know, someone who does write 20 songs a year and they're all average, because they don't have that inbuilt filter? It's a balancing act, you know. I think, yeah, there is never one rule. There's never one model for doing it. You know, I'm always amused by people that say, what do you write first, the words or the music? And you think, well, you don't really know much about songwriting, because there is no rule, you know. I think if you try to distill it down to a rule, then you're in trouble. I think you need to have your antenna open to whatever it is that makes you respond to something in a fashion that then says, can you distill this into a poetic expression with music involved? Maybe you can, maybe you can't, but there are, you know, there's many different ways that songwriters come to find inspiration. That's only a very small part of the journey. If you're lucky, you find it often enough that you can create interesting and worthwhile work, you know. But that's the songwriter's dilemma. Quantity, quality, all of those things come into the mix. Who you work with, how you work, what you then apply to how you've written your stuff, how you produce it.
Well,
it's endless.
Not only is it about applying ourselves when the inspiration strikes, but it's about applying ourselves when the inspiration strikes and when all the other timing is right, when everything aligns.
Mm.
And that could just be the way we woke, the energy we had when we woke up that day, or what we did the night before. We were having a conversation before we started recording about using methods and practicing methods to keep yourself in the flow of writing. And The only time I can think of when I just cannot write, this is not talking about the depth or the quality of my writing, but if I'm really exhausted physically, I have to stop, because I've spent countless nights with my head falling onto the guitar, and I just go, why am I doing this? You know, but I think that in terms of inspiration, in terms of applying it to a songwriting process as a practice, I think that if we pursue our curiosities, in other words, we're always looking for inspiration, that's got to be a good thing.
Yeah.
Acting on that, to apply it to our songwriting, it might not happen the next day, it might not happen that day, it might not happen for a few weeks or a few months, but I think that ultimately we're storing all that information. Yeah. And that's why note-taking is vital.
I think with different people, there are different tools they can employ, and for some people there's actually absolute worth in taking down notes, or, you know, having a discipline that says, I need to do this at this time. I need to, you know, be open to, you know, it might be I need to read something to inspire me. I need to read poetry to inspire me. I need to read inspirational quotes to inspire me. I mean, that's useful if you need that, absolutely. And there are no rules to any of this, you know, but if you can codify your practices and pull some disciplines around them, That's a bad thing.
Read poetry to inspire you, but read poetry to inspire you with the intention of applying it to your creative process. Mm. There's a difference. Mm. I'm inspired most days because I make the effort to find stimulating, inspirational writings or whatever it is I pursue. But I do that because it's always in my mind as a deliberate songwriter. Mm. It's always in my mind to apply what I'm learning when it strikes, when the timing's right.
A lot of writers, you know, their friends get a bit toey, a bit nervous around them, because they figure that whatever they're going to give to their writer friend is going to somehow find its way into their writings. And that's true. It's writers write what they know, and they write what they encounter. If they're good, then they write it well, and there's something that people will recognize in a universal sense that speaks, you know, beyond that person's personal foibles or endeavors, and that's a writer, you know. So yeah, whatever, I think self-awareness is the key to all of this. You need to be self-aware. You need to understand, or try to understand, what it is that sparks you, what it is that, you know, when you're not up for writing in any great shape, you know, it's like an athlete. If your brain's not up for it, or your body's not up for it, you're hardly going to get a good result. And that shouldn't surprise you when you do. So people get frustrated because they're in, you know, they're writing and nothing's coming. Man, you've got to tend to something before you start the writing to make sure that you're in a good position to give yourself a chance.
Well, friends, I thought I'd cut in here and leave you with a conversation with Michael Roberts, part one. Just maybe some of that can sit with you for a few days, and I'll post part two. I thought it was a pretty lengthy conversation, so it may be a good time to have a rest and contemplate what was said. I really hope you've got some value from that. I know I did. I do every time I speak with Michael Roberts. And thanks so much again for being here. It's amazing. I'm so grateful that you want to tune into this podcast. My name's Carl Brody. Until next time, be safe out there. All the best.